I was asked not more than 10 minutes ago if I got nervous before these things, and the answer in general is no. I've spoken publicly all my life, most of my life, but always there's a very momentary flash of apprehension during an introduction that I always refer to as stark terror. And if you just bear with me a minute until I get airborne. What? By the way, I happen to be an alcoholic, and if you saw that film and did not guess that, you still need a little attention. What perhaps you don't know is the way that thing began. It was filmed by a Navy photographer with a single camera in a conference room in the Federal Building in Washington, D.C. in February of 1972. And I was one of several speakers at a day-long seminar for some personnel from federal agencies. There were about 50 people in the room. And I began by saying that we human beings have a kind of genius for making mistakes, where most of us are quite good at it. And I believe that most errors in judgment are a result of ignorance rather than knowledge. It's what we don't know that causes most mistakes. Some mistakes are funny. There was a nun going to confession one afternoon. She tripped and fell going into the confessional, but it was so dark, priest couldn't see who it was. So that was the missing fact. He didn't know it was a nun. All he heard was someone had fallen. He was quite concerned, and so he said, "What's wrong?" And the voice came back and said, "Excuse me, I'm so nervous." He said, "Why?" She said, "My children." She taught the second grade. They were killing her. He said, "How many children do you have?" She said, 42. He said, "Get the hell out of here. I thought you were drunk when you fell in." Well, that's just kind of a humorous little thing. But the way this film of the Chalk Talk began, I told a story that was, it illustrated a mistake that was funny, it was embarrassing, and it was painful. The government got paranoid that there might be some ethnic repercussions, so they cut it out. And I don't know why. I thought it was a good one. It seems that one afternoon there was an old Oriental gentleman who became quite irate over the fact that somebody had tossed his outhouse over the hill. He had two kids. They were both boys. One was 8 and one was 9. He called them in. And he asked them point blank, "You know who threw Papa-san outhouse over hill?" And they didn't know. So he sat them down. And he said, "All right, to tell you a story of an American boy named George Washington who one day chopped down a Papa-san Washington cherry tree. Papa-san Washington called him in, asked him if he know about cherry tree, and George say, 'Papa-san, no can tell right. It was I who chopped down your cherry tree.' Papa-san Washington pat him on head, give him cookie for to tell the truth. The 9-year-old jumped up with a big grin and announces loud, 'Papa-san, it was I who threw your outhouse over hill.' And the old man damn near killed him. When the poor little kid came to, he asked the obvious. He said, 'Papa-san, for why you tell story of virtue get reward? George Washington tell truth get cookie. I tell truth, you whip me.' And the old man told him why. He said, 'Only one difference. When George Washington chopped down a Papa-san Washington cherry tree, Papa-san Washington not in cherry tree.'" The big difference. It was funny, it was embarrassing, it was painful. You never make such a mistake about an alcoholic. Any mistake you make about an alcoholic is always tragic. Always. I had people who knew what they were doing when it came to me, and that's why I'm alive tonight. I would like to tell you a little bit about what I used to be like, what happened, and what it's like now. When I grow too old to learn, I will have grown too old, and I hope I'm learning on my deathbed. There are two people in my life, a man and a woman, who love me so much that everything they say to me, whether it's by way of suggestion, sometimes correction, and and painfully enough, reprimand. They love me so much that whenever they offer me any of this, I know it comes from one single, simple, solitary motive. It's for me to be better than I am. And if you love me enough to offer anything to me with that motivation, I'll do two things. I will thank you for it, and I will act on it. Anything and everything I say tonight are personal convictions. They may cause pain. That is not my intention. If it causes pain, I am sorry indeed that anyone hurts. But what I say comes from love. You see, I love AA as much as you do. And everything I say is to make us all better. These convictions of mine have built up over the years. If you can use them, please do. If you disagree with any, simply push them aside, but don't argue with me about them. They're mine. And I would begin by saying that you and I are human beings. We are capable of error. I heard it said that AA is the greatest university on earth. That's provided your teacher knows what he's talking about. We are not infallible, any of us, nor all of us together. And that's why they wrote a big book for us, to lay down guidelines if ever we did lead each other astray. We even learn how to tell our stories from each other. But the big book lays down the proper guideline. Our stories disclose in a general way what we used to be like, what happened to what it's like now, in a general way. In the initial days of AA, Bill Wilson had a lifetime of drinking and 6 months of sobriety to share. Dr. Bob had a lifetime of drinking and about 6 minutes of sobriety to share, so the emphasis was on the drinking years. But today we have a lot of sobriety to share with each other. I'm pretty good at taking other people's inventory. It's one of my favorite indoor sports. And at an AA meeting, I listen to a speaker and I clock the amount of time he dedicates to his sick years and the amount of time he dedicates to his well years. I have a pretty good indication of his present condition. I'm not saying don't tell me your drinking story. I am saying don't just tell me how sick you got. Tell me how well you're getting, because that's why I come to these rooms, to learn how to get sober and stay that way. I've adopted a principle when I tell my own story. I say nothing without a purpose. It prevents a whole lot of padding and a whole lot of unnecessary drivel. What the hell difference does it make if you puke 14 times and I puke 12? So what? I will tell you enough about my drinking to let you know I belong here and to let me know I belong here, and that's it. You know what I am utterly convinced of? If we tell our stories as Bill Wilson envisioned it, for the purpose with which he envisioned it, I believe that every alcoholic on earth should be able to identify with me. I think there are very few priests in the room. You can't identify with me from that angle. But I believe if I tell my story right, the details of my drinking should indicate two things. When I drank alcohol, I didn't control it. It controlled me. And number two, it caused problems. You see, if I could control my intake of alcohol without problems, I'd be drinking now. So would you. And everything I say about my drinking will indicate or point to those two facts. That's it. My drinking was completely unspectacular. It's not even as juicy as the drinking stories of a whole lot of non-alcoholics, I'm sure. So if any of you showed up tonight to hear the lurid details of the drinking priest's past, you may as well go home. I just wasn't that good at being that bad. I'd like to share with you some things I've learned about what it means to be an alcoholic. It's based on a general principle that is so self-evident you can't prove it. What causes trouble is trouble, because it causes trouble. An alcoholic is somebody whose drinking causes trouble. You see, when your drinking makes problems, it's one. Now, what are some indications of this? If your drinking is unlike that of normal drinkers. You know, this whole bloody business is so simple. As I've said in that guidelines talk, my God, if a little child can diagnose the illness, we ought to be able to. You want to know what an alcoholic is? Ask your kids. And by the way, you know, there is a general guideline for normalcy. It's what normal people do. And I've heard people in AA say, ho, 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 what's a normal drinker? I've never met one. And my answer to that is, ho, 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 look who the hell you used to drink with. No wonder you don't know any. Let me offer this for your consideration. See if the obvious doesn't become obvious. I think that an alcoholic is someone whose drinking becomes a topic of serious conversation on the part of friends. Did you ever sit around with three or four couples seriously discussing somebody else's intake of sliced tomatoes? Gee, you should have seen him at lunch the other day. 15. We don't do that. But we talk about people's drinking. Lying about your drinking. Okay, if you're new to the program or if you think you might have a drinking problem but don't want to have one, just try these simple little questions. Never lie about your drinking. Just a big old yes or no. My friends, normal drinkers have no reason to lie about their drinking. You see, a lie is an unnatural act. It's a prostitution of the mind which is made for truth. And I'm not talking just about the verbal lie. Have you ever lived a lie? Have you ever tried to cover up a hangover? See, a normal drinker doesn't cover it up. He walks into the office and announces it. Never again. What a head. We bury it under Sensen and Scope. And, you know, here she comes, old drugstore Doris. You know, you can smell it. Did you ever hide a bottle? Did you ever hide one from yourself? You know, one of the most horrible experiences in human existence is to discover a bottle you've hidden if you've been in AA 4 years. Ah! Normal drinkers don't do that. And you know, for all the intelligence represented here, including me, we were so smart. You know one of the greatest, most earth-shattering problems we faced when we were drinking? How to get rid of empty bottles. A little kid look at you and say, throw them out. That's simple. That's much too simple. Much too simple. When I was first ordained, I was sent to teach out in Mountain View, California. I had two suitcases in my room, and I used them to hold empties. And when they got full, I emptied them. I don't know why I saved two suitcases full, but I waited till the kids were in class, and I used to take these empties. There were about 40 or 50 of them. Each suitcase would hold about 20 apiece. I'd get down to our, we had our dump behind the barn, and you had to go past all the athletic facilities and the ball fields and so on to get there. So I waited till they were in class, picked up my suitcases, and headed out. You know, it never dawned on me that all they had to do was look out the window. And what they would have seen, me, dressed in a flowing black cassock, carrying two suitcases, heading off all alone into the hills. You know, it never dawned on me that they might have thought that been slightly weird. Right? But when I got to the dump, I used to bury these dead soldiers one at a time on top of the heap, consoled by the fact that every one of those dead soldiers had a priest with him when he died. Old Doc Green at Guest House, he used to have a marvelous little saying where you find four priests, you usually find a fifth. Well, I changed that slightly for later use, but here was one who didn't want the other three around. I was hospitalized for my drinking. I got out of the hospital, started to drink again, and 2 weeks later, this is in the spring of the year, I was on an airplane headed east. I was a teacher. Three priests had to pick up my courses and complete them. Ladies and gentlemen, I have never been transferred the length of a nation because of trouble with French fries. Never. Alcohol. You know what an alcoholic is? Look at the major problems of your life. Has the bottle been in the picture before, during, or after? If your answer is yes, sign up. I spent the next 2 years of my life at St. Charles College in Baltimore, Maryland, in total misery. And every one of you who has ever had trouble with drinking has experienced this. I tried to stop and found that I couldn't. And then the fear sets in. Our illness teaches us one thing, and we learn the lesson well. That's how to be scared to death. When you lie on your bed with your stomach quivering, staring at the ceiling, and just about die when your telephone rings. Now, what in the name of God does your MA or your PhD have to do with that? And the only thing that alleviates the terror is another drink in the vicious circle. Over and over again. Alcohol is a liquid. Do you know what a liquid is, by definition? A substance that takes the shape of its container. It doesn't even have shape. And it controlled my life. a chemical controlled my life. Your life wasn't unmanageable. My friends, when we were drinking, alcohol controlled 98% of our waking thoughts. It dictated the people we associated with and those we stayed away from. It determined the restaurants we went into and those we stayed out of. We either thought of having drunk or going to drink. Alcohol dominated and controlled the noblest faculty that we have, the mind, through the biochemistry of our bodies. What is an alcoholic? God, there are a million definitions, but see if you recognize anything in this. An alcoholic is a creature lopped off from the very purpose for which it was made, to love. Chairs are made to be sat on. Airplanes are made to be flown. A chair is a chair when it's folded up in a closet, but it is most a chair when you're sitting in it. That's why it was built. An airplane is an airplane when it's in a hangar for repairs, but it is most an airplane when it's in the sky. We are creatures made in the image of God. We have a mind for truth and a heart for love. You and I are love machines. That's why we exist. We were created to love. And an alcoholic, by the very biochemical nature of his addiction, is shackled to himself. And love reaches out to others. I love you. And the alcoholic can't do that. That is why, in total frustration, locked off from the very purpose for which we exist, many of us seek the out of death. Suicide. And yet many alcoholics aren't even good at that. An alcoholic is a fish out of water. A fish has gills through which it breathes oxygen from water. We have lungs through which we breathe oxygen through air. Take a fish out of water and watch it die. Watch it rise and flip and flop, screaming in silence for the very oxygen which it doesn't have. That's us when we were drinking. That's why we're frustrated. We are islands of misery. My drinking would put you to sleep. And yet I knew I was the most miserable creature on earth, but I could have named 1,000 people that drank worse than I do. Every one of us feels completely alone, totally frustrated and miserable. We're afraid to live, which is worse than being afraid to die. And we crawl into the bottle. But I had a man who loved me enough that after certain things happened to me, he got me well. I was invited out of a parish where I was helping out on Sundays. I was invited out of my Sister Frances' home. She's my favorite sister. She wrote me a letter to stay away. This does not happen to normal drinkers. That's what an alcoholic is. Somebody who's drinking makes trouble. And the only difference between the troubles in my life and the troubles in your life is a question of details. I was a teaching priest, and it was threatened by my drinking. My superior said, you cannot continue to drink and continue to teach. The students are talking about your drinking. But that man loved me enough to get me well. And his confrontation was gorgeous. He didn't ask me anything. With the gentleness of a father, and if ever a man deserved the epithet, he did. He was a sick man all his life. And toward the end, he died of a massive hiatus hernia, which caused him, like Pope Pius XII, to hiccup to death. He went for months without sleeping longer than 5 minutes at a time. He just wore out. And that man drove. Instead of calling me on the phone, he drove from his house out to the college to tell me in person, we are sending you away this summer to get well. And the reason he drove out there was to put my fear to rest. He said, this is not punitive. We want you to get well. And I went to a place called Guest House, just for alcoholic priests, and I'd like to tell you what happened there. Ladies and gentlemen, one of the strongest convictions I have about the sober life is the absolute, complete, utter necessity of a sponsor. We functioned alone when we drank, didn't we? And I would bet over 50% of you are functioning alone on your own brand of AA now, sober. I don't want that kind of sobriety. My friends, no one is judging his own case. I could give it to them. If I have that problem, I need somebody else to tell it to me. My God, my friends, if we could stand alone, we would stand alone. And I've had that. It was not the 12 steps of AA printed on paper that saved my life. Somebody could have mailed them to me. I could have read them in my room and died drunk. You see, I've been preaching those 12 steps all my life. Hey, friends, AA didn't invent them. They simply discovered them. Normal, good people had been living them all along. Those 12 steps came from the religious leaders of the day to whom these two men reached out for help. It was not the 12 steps on paper that saved my life. It was the 12 steps carved in another man's life that saved me. His name was Austin Ripley. It was a man who saved my life. Within 10 minutes of being in his presence, I wanted to be just like him. I wanted everything he had. And for those two reasons, I would have died to please him. I'm not saying that because it sounds romantic or poetic. I'm dead serious. If he had told me to sleep on the floor, I would have slept on the floor without question. Without question. I had someone in whom I had total confidence, and that's what every one of us needs. That's what every one of us needs. Someone in whom you have confidence. I was lucky I had a man in whom I had complete confidence. I knew that he knew alcoholism. I knew he knew me. All I had to do was what he told me. They tell a marvelous story about confidence. There's a man in Bavaria, outside of whose back door was the highest mountain in the country. And all his life he dreamed of climbing it. And at the age of 47, he did. And he set out one morning, climbed all the way up, and he got about a foot and a half from the top, and he was so elated at having succeeded that he just threw his arms out in joy. Of course, he lost his grip. Down he comes, zinging through the sky. And out of the side of his eye, he sees a branch jutting out of the rock, and he grabbed it. It nearly ripped his arms out of his shoulder. And after the pain subsided and he opened his eyes, he took a reading on the situation. He's holding on to this tree. There's nothing up, there's nothing down, there's nothing on either side, there's not even a fingernail grip. The need was there. And so he looked up into that vast expanse of blue and he said, "Anybody up there?" And the voice came back immediately. He said, "Yes, Henry, this is the Lord. You want out from that situation. Follow these simple instructions. Number one, let go of that branch." Anybody else up there? That's what we do, isn't it? Have you ever noticed that nobody really wants advice? Really. I had a priest come to me with a drinking problem. And he used up a solid 3 hours of my time. And when he got to the end of his little story, I asked the simplest question of them all. I said, "What'd you come to me for?" He said, "I want your help." I said, "I'll give it. Go to guest house." Well, he says, "I can't do that." Most of us don't want advice. We want backing. We want to hear what we want to hear. And this is where I almost had it made. I wanted to be like Austin Ripley so bad that all he had to do was tell me anything, I'd have tried it. I'd have tried it. And don't hand me this stuff about the tradition that says place principles before personalities. I know that, and I try to do that. But our tradition does not say to place principles instead of personalities. If you don't have a hero, you'd better get one. The day I stop being a hero worshiper, you can bury me because I will cease to have been human. We are built that way. It was the 12 steps carved in that man's life that drew me to sobriety. I wanted what he had. And in effect, he said, "If you want what I've got, then you do what I did." I said, "What did you do?" He said, "12 little things." I said, "Oh." He didn't tell me how tough they were. He just said there were 12 of them. Number one, you want to get well, admit you're sick. Now, how do I know I'm sick? Everybody else told me. Please listen to this. I think it's important. A couple went to West Point to see their son graduate. The entire corps of cadets marched by in review. And as they went by, the mother turns to the father and says, "Oh, James, isn't that fantastic? 4,000 cadets out there, and our little George is the only one in step." Friends, when the whole world is out of step except me, I'm out of step. And the whole world was telling me I had a drinking problem. The whole world was telling me I had a drinking problem. And so all I had to do was admit I was powerless over alcohol. And as little Doc Green used to say, if you don't believe it, look at the records. There's not an alcoholic in this room who has to go out and try once more to prove what he's already proven 1,000 times. The honesty of looking at the records. The word powerless is an absolute. No power. Gone. Gone. We have to start with that premise, because if on the back burners here you think that there is a vague possibility that you have some sort of control, you will probably try. To me, step one is not something I take and then go on. It is a realization of my condition, and I have to keep deepening it every day of my life until I die. It's an awareness of my condition. My friends, I do not know most of you. I've never seen a one of you with a glass in your hand. You tell me you're an alcoholic, I must believe you. The one thing I am infallibly certain of is that I am an alcoholic. I am. There's a vast difference between an intellectual acknowledgement. Yes, I've seen all those talks, I've read all the literature, and indeed I do believe that perhaps I am an alcoholic. There's a difference between saying it that way and saying I am an alcoholic. You know the beauty of that? Once I know my weakness, I can function accordingly. I can't handle alcohol, so I don't try. Ta-da! That's what it's about. It is not weak to admit a weakness. And it is a weakness, you know. It's a biochemical weakness. I can't handle it. You know one of the most beautiful definitions of alcoholic I ever heard? Guy got up in an AA meeting about 17 years ago back in Baltimore. He said, my filter's busted. It made more sense than all the garbage I had been subjected to up till then. When I drink booze, it's different from the way other people drink booze. So I have to acknowledge that. But you know what we're like, you and I, when we're drinking? Men and women who climb into a boxing ring with a champ every day and get beat up. Keep trying. 82 years of this, we climb out of bed all black and blue, on hands and knees, heading for the ring. Guess what's going on in this brilliant think tank? How can I not get beat up today? You know what we're doing while we're asking this? Putting the gloves on. AA leans over your shoulder and says, don't get in the ring. Too simple. Too simple. But AA says, if you don't take a drink, you can't get drunk. If you know what your weakness is, you can function accordingly. Your whole life can be built around that fact. Let me show you what I mean. Max Schmeling predicted he was going to beat Joe Louis, and he did. And when the fight was over, he said, I studied the film, and I saw his weakness, and I capitalized on it. He had a certain combination of punches, and after a given punch, his guard was open. And he said, I knew if I could hit him at that split second, I could take him. And he did. Joe Louis was knocked out in the 12th round. Then Max Schmeling's weakness became known. He published that, and Joe Louis read it. Of course, the next fight is history. Once you know your weakness, you live accordingly. I can't handle alcohol. I function accordingly. Now, my friends, this business of fear and respect. The word fear is not dirty, and Bill Wilson did not mean to imply that all fear should leave our life. We just recited the Serenity Prayer, did we not? God grant me the wisdom to know the difference. The fear of the Lord is the beginning of wisdom. Some fears are good, you know. If you in this room are not afraid enough of fire to take precautions against it, you are insane. And if a man-eating tiger were to appear here, I would create a brand new door in this building up there. That's a very healthy fear. I fear alcohol. It's not a cringing fear, but I hope to God that I go to my grave being afraid that drinking alcohol will kill me. Because the day I lose that fear, I'm going to try to drink it. A lot of people in AA, they think fear is a dirty word. Bill Wilson meant that our unreasonable fears should disappear when we get well. Like fear of the dark, fear of authority, fear of a phone. Those things go. But we learn then to have a very healthy fear of alcohol. Some people say, I don't fear it, I respect it. If you do, be my guest. I don't. To me, respect means to look up to. You respect your parents. You know? I respect people, I respect principles. I'll be damned if I respect a chemical that nearly killed me. What would you think of your kid if he went home tonight and he said, gee, Dad, thanks for the roller skates. I really respect them. You'd look at him. I do not respect alcohol. I have a very healthy fear of it, and I hope to God I die with that fear. All right, that's a negative thing. We admitted we were powerless over alcohol. Our lives had become unmanageable. What do we do about it? The night after I got to guest house, he ushered me into an AA meeting in Pontiac, Michigan. And I met about 25 people, every one of whom said he was an alcoholic, she was an alcoholic. But they were all sober. The guy said, I'm sober 22 years. I got 2 days at this point. 22 years. Lady said 15. Somebody else said 11, 18, 9, 4, 7. Around the room. Wait a minute. You are powerless over alcohol. Right. The power to not drink is not in you. Right. But you haven't had a drink in 22 years? Right. Where'd you get it? Well, he said, if it ain't in, it's out. I said, oh. How simple can you get? Ladies and gentlemen, if we are powerless over alcohol, it is insanity at its worst to dig inside looking for power that's not there. We reach out for help. Some people have trouble with the power greater than themselves. Friends, if you are having trouble with a higher power, try mirror therapy. You go to the Five and Dime and you buy a cheap mirror and you look at it. It should take you about 4 seconds. And if, within that space of time, looking at the mirror, you cannot come to the conclusion that somewhere, someplace, there's got to be something bigger than what you're looking at, you are sickerino. What do we all say when we come into AA? We're powerless. Come on. So, you know, I've heard professionals say, AA is a crutch. When you break your leg, you get on a crutch, don't you? Crutches are marvelous. Husbands depend on wives, do they not? We depend on Cronkite for the news, the milkman for milk. What's evil about having a crutch? My God, ladies and gentlemen, if we didn't have crutches, again, we would stand alone. I don't want that. You know what AA begins to teach us when we walk into one of those rooms for the first time? That most magnificent of all things that is human, our sweet dependence on each other. I need you. And then as we get well, we come to a realization when our humanity is restored to us through these 12 steps. And we become well and we stand tall and we walk tall. Some years ago I was part of the problem, today I'm part of the answer. Do you know one of the most gratifyingly beautiful thoughts that can occur to any human soul? You need me. You need me. That's what AA restored me to. And I came to it through you. I came into a room and I looked at sober people and I came to believe I could get sober too. Some people in AA circles say, if you don't have a higher power, try that coffee cup or that fence post. My God, how can we do that? I do not belong to Coffee Cups Anonymous. I belong to Alcoholics Anonymous. People get people sober. And the guy who says that has never prayed to a coffee cup to keep him sober. He never holds one up at his anniversary and says, hi, kids, meet my sponsor. Why do we say things like that? The only approach I use to an alcoholic who is having trouble with the God notion as a higher power is, why don't you take the power of the group? The group is bigger than I am. One of AA's most magnificent slogans is that we can do what I can't. A kid can break a string, but take 1,000 of them and wrap them together, you can build a horse or to pull a carrier. That's what this is all about, my friend. You and I meeting each other and getting a job done that none of us can do starkly alone. So we come to believe that it can be done by looking at it being done. I am looking at sober faces. I personally believe in a God, a supreme being, who acts through you to reach me. One of many ways that he does it. Sometimes he does directly. I am not here as a priest pushing Catholic theology. Forget that. But I'd like to share a few notions that I've picked up about God and me over the years. We have marvelous slogans in AA. One of which is, let go and let God. Now that's great, you know what it means. But can you imagine some poor slob, drunk for 31 years, he walks in, somebody looks at him and says, hey, Bunky, you got a little trouble? He hadn't paid the rent in 42 years, been through 14 marriages, lost 100,000 jobs, you know. Somebody says, let go and let God. He stands there cross-eyed thinking, let God what? You know what those words would have sounded like to me if someone had said them to me the first time? I mean, with my background. All right, Father, you having trouble with your drinking? Yes. Have you tried to quit? Yes. Let go and let God. I would have done that. I would have quit trying. I said, all right, God, if you're the one who does it, do it. I'm willing. Go ahead. God doesn't work that way. What I have learned about God is that he supplies the power to not drink, and then he gives me the opportunity and the means of exercising the power, which is the rest of the steps. But I do the steps, not him. Faith moves mountains. Bring a shovel. bring a shovel. The illustration always used a little farm kid who was afraid of the dark. Somebody forgot to bring a newspaper up one night, and the mailbox is about 400 yards from the house. So the mother says, "Georgie, go get the paper." Georgie says, he starts bawling. She says, "What's the matter with you?" He says, "I'm afraid of the dark." She sits him down, puts her arms around him, says, "Honey, there's nothing to be afraid of." He says, "Why?" She says, "Because God's out there. God's everywhere. He's out in the dark, just like he's right here in this room." The kid lit up like a Christmas tree, ran to the door, opened it, stuck his arm out, and asked God to hand him a newspaper. And that's the impression we give to a lot of people when we say let go and let God. Have you ever heard or have you ever used these words? Because somebody used, and you know what we do in AA? We repeat without thought. "Well, my life's a little unmanageable. I think I better turn it over to God. I believe I better get out of the driver's seat." Don't do that. You have a wreck. God doesn't come down and make your decisions for you and drive your car. He gives you maps. That's God's role. He gives us the principles to live by, but it's just like a doctor. You go to a doctor, the only thing he gives you is a prescription. You get it filled, and you take the medicine. The same way in AA. We do the steps. So I have to make a decision to get in touch, to find out what God's will is, and try to do it. You know what God's will is for us alcoholics? God, you don't need books. You don't have to figure out a whole lot. He wants the alcoholic to get sober and stay that way. How? The rest of the steps. That's God's will for us. And we spend the rest of our lives doing it. Now, please, we come to the middle step, the steps of growing, the steps of once the alcohol is out of the way. Step one, I can't handle it. Step two, God can. Step three, I believe I'll get in touch. Now we come to cleaning up and getting on with living without alcohol. Watch the magnificent psychological progress of these steps. Step two, power greater than ourselves. Step three, God as we understood him. Step five, admitted to God. Step seven, humbly ask him. The fear is being put to sleep. Please don't ever appeal to an alcoholic's sense of shame. We alcoholics know shame that other people never even heard of. Most of us are so scared of God that some of us say there is none. But watch how as we get more and more sober with the strength and the buoyancy given us by the group, power greater than ourselves, God as we understood him, God and then him. What a beautiful progress. You notice now the steps are coming in pairs? You notice the beautiful logical layout of these 12 steps? Magnificent. When you and I were drinking, we were characterized at least one characteristic every alcoholic has in common. Lots of pep and no judgment. There's an airplane that took off from New York headed for Rome. It belonged to the Alitalia Airlines. An Italian story, folks. It's in the air about an hour, and the loudspeaker gets clicked on, and you hear the voice. "Hello," I said, "this is your pilot." "In a few minutes, the pretty stewardess, she's going to come and serve you lunch. So I hope you enjoy it, but it'll be full lunch. And I got a 2 ounce. "One's good news, one's bad news." "I'll give you the bad news first. Announcement number one, we lost." "I ain't got no idea where we could be." "Hold on for the good news. We're making a damn good time." The alcoholic. Now, when we're drinking, we have the foggiest notion where we're going, but we're getting there quick. Take the drug out of the body. Let the mind begin to get well. Now we're supposed to use it. The I is back over the E. Intellect now predominates. And so when we are asked to act, we prepare and then execute like normal people. Admit you're sick. Take on a regime to get well. Enter a room and look. Come to believe. Make a decision to turn your life over and then do it. Make an inventory, make it known. Become willing to have your defects removed and then ask. The magnificent brilliance of rational living that AA offers to us. The inventory, you know what it does? It shows us what we've got, what we haven't got, and what has to go. And friends, forevermore, let this business of honesty pervade every aspect of our lives. It just doesn't have to do with admitting we're alcoholics. It has to do with stark honesty. Do you know that every one of you in this room has talent? Why do we deny it? Why do we go through the phony humility of denying what is so? Humility, friends, is truth. I've got talent. What I have to do is acknowledge where they came from and what they're to be used for. Have you ever heard this at an AA? Honest to heavens, I'll never forget the first time I ever heard it. I almost turned inside out. Fellow said, and I don't know, he was repeating what he had heard from others because I've heard it several times since. Well, when I was drinking, I was a drunken SOB, but now I'm sober 14 years. Well, I don't have anything to show for it, but at least I'm a sober SOB. If you're still an SOB after 14 years of sobriety, something's wrong, pal.
Now, if that is just said to get a laugh, the next time you hear somebody say it, go up to him after the meeting and say, you know, Henry, I too have noticed your lack of progress. After a meeting in Charleston, South Carolina one year, the group gave me a little plaque. It has a saying on it. It hangs in my home. It's almost terrifying in its implications. Listen to the words. Be careful what you do or say. You may be the only big book somebody will ever read. Friend, when you're up here and I'm down there, you are playing with my life. Now, you bloody well be careful what you do with it. Austin Ripley gave us a clue. Treat yourself very lightly, but treat this disease with the deadly seriousness that it demands. My friends, what right have we to be in this room? For every alcoholic who survives, at least in the 1970s, approximately 10 are going to die. What right do we have to be here? None. I have no right to be sober. Have you the foggiest notion of the responsibility that is wrapped up in that gift? We don't do these steps because they're nice. We do them because they're necessary. Bill and Dr. Bob were not out to write a handbook of monasticism. My God, they were seeking guidelines to live by, to survive by. They just wanted to continue to breathe. And I think that if it could have been done in 10 steps, that's all there'd be. Because they accepted all the help that came in, they kept what worked and threw out what didn't. They kept the skeleton of survival. The old Camel cigarettes used to have a slogan, if you want a treat instead of a treatment, smoke Camels. I changed that for my AA life. I go to meetings for a treatment, not a treat. You do not have to be funny when you speak at an AA meeting. It's the message that counts. Now, if you can do it in an entertaining way, that will be more pleasing. If you can be funny, God, I love humorous speakers. But that's not why I'm at an AA meeting. That's just gravy. That's just gravy. If the speaker has to be a good speaker. But that's beyond the point. Every one of you in this room has some talent peculiar to yourself. You know what I believe? I can't prove this, but I believe it. I believe that sometime before you die, you're going to be asked to use that talent to touch another human life that nobody else will be able to get near. I think you better find out what it is. But you know what we do? We have to find out what we don't have. I am not a singer of operatic quality. I can't throw footballs like John Unitas. But I've reconciled myself to that. Do you know that every one of us is inferior to everybody else on the face of God's earth? And AA, as a kind mother, when we're old enough in our sobriety, she tells us that. She looks us right in the eye and says, never dawn on you that you might have an inferiority complex because you're inferior. But for, you know, if you really want to know whether a person is sincere when he uses these self-deprecating remarks, agree with him. Gee, George, that was a beautiful talk. It helped me immensely. George says, oh, it wasn't much. You say, you know, on second thought, it did stink. And this business of gratitude, God, we yak about it all the time. But have you ever heard this phoniness? It's happened to me before. Somebody does me a favor. Somebody gives me a gift. I say, holy smoke, thank you so much. You know, down in Texas, a year ago, they gave me a cowboy hat, and this year they gave me a pair of alligator lizard boots. My God, they're beautiful. And I'm on my knees thanking this guy, you know, because I happen to know what they cost. And he said, you're welcome. It was a pleasure. That's normal. What is not normal is to go up to someone who has done you a giant favor and say, thank you so much, and you get one of these. You don't have to thank me. Just thank God. Oh, come on. If I do you a favor, you better thank me. Have you ever heard yourself speak when someone does not thank you? Geez, I bent over backwards for that guy. And this is a quote. Son of a bitch never even said thanks. We are built that way. Why don't we acknowledge it? Why don't we acknowledge it? Gratitude is an essential thing. Well, what I'm after is the normal... You know, when somebody thanks you, you say, you're welcome. A lot of us don't even know how to accept a compliment. But I think that the fourth step shows us the real... You know, every one of us is three. I am who I think I am. I am who you think I am. And then there's me. The fourth step shows me who I am. You know what the fifth step does? My friends, Austin Ripley used to say this over and over and over again. Steps four and five separate the men from the boys and the big girls from the little girls. You want to find out something startling about people who say they live the program? Well, I practice these steps to the best of my ability. I could kneel in front of people like that. 12 things all day, every day at the same time. I have a horrible time walking and breathing at the same time. I honestly, my friends, I don't know as I've ever done anything to the best of my ability. I just envy people who say, I work this program to the best of my ability. I've gone for months without having even been conscious of step 10 or step 7 or whatever. I really do believe we have to be careful of what we think and what we say and what we do in AA. Admitted to God. Well, that's fairly easy. He knows anyway. To ourselves, that's a little tough. But to another human being, Austin Ripley used to say over and over again, the value of these steps will come to you only after you have done them. You should do them because they ought to be done and people are telling you to do them. They are essential to good, happy, effective, productive sobriety. You want to have fun at an AA meeting? Next time you're asked to chair, say, let's talk about steps 4 and 5, and I would like to bet $1,000 to an empty peanut shell that 50% of the people at that meeting will take the time for their talking to let you know reasons why they have not yet done these difficult things. Rip used to tell us at Guest House, don't you ever dare say anything at an AA meeting unless you've done it yourself or are willing to. And step 5 was the single most difficult thing I've ever done in my life. My friends, there is unbelievable therapy in the realization that one other human being knows the real me. I've said often, and I am not joking, if you knew the real me, you probably would not talk to me. The best way to humility is through humiliation. And there's nothing more humiliating than step 5. But see, it takes big people to do that. 6 and 7. I'll tell you what I've learned about growth. I'm not saying that I'm growing overly or I'm rushing ahead into maturity. I'm just saying I would like to tell you a few things I've learned about. We become willing to have God remove them, then we ask him to do it. Well, a great drawback is that stumbling block, step 6, to become willing. And there are a few faults that I have that I'm not yet willing to release. I think that's true of most of us. That's why we don't talk about these steps much. And you know, it kills me to hear some guy say, well, at least after 114 years of sobriety, I am aware of my shortcomings. My God, so are we. Don't tell me you're aware. What are you doing? You know what I learned about my alcoholism? I couldn't handle it by myself. I had to get help. I admitted I was powerless over alcohol, and then I had to come to believe that a power greater than myself could help me. The same thing is true with our defects of character. I tried to handle them for 52 years, and I still have... Well, my defects have character. Some are beauties. Anyway. But you know how God removes our... You know, we humbly asked him to remove our shortcomings. Somehow or other, I believe that he's going to handle them differently from the way he handled my alcoholism, and that's not true. I just believe that if I keep praying for patience, he's going to go and wipe it out. He didn't do that with my alcoholism. He said, I'll give you the power, and then you will have the opportunity to exercise it. You know what I believe about prayer? Prayer is a means to the end. We have no right to pray for the miracle, really. Because God wants us to take the natural means to the end. I truly believe that he wants us to go to a dentist when we have a toothache. Does that mean that prayer is ineffectual? No. Say a prayer. On your way to the dentist. I'm not joking. I believe this. If I were to pray tonight for God to make me a doctor by tomorrow morning, he could. I'm not joking. I do believe that. But I believe that he would want me to take the natural meeting. He could waft all of you home after this meeting is over, but I believe that he wants you to drive the way you came. And what I believe about prayer is this, that if I were to pray to God tonight to make me a doctor, his answer would be, fine, go to med school. I really do. And this is the way we grow in a spiritual life. Ladies and gentlemen, grass grows according to the laws of biology and zoology that govern it. And we grow spiritually, that is the non-physical life, the development of our mind, our emotions, our will. In other words, growth in maturity goes according to law. We will grow a day's growth in a day's time, providing we're doing everything. What do? We pray to God to remove the defect and then look for the opportunities that he places at our disposal to use the power to do it. For example, let's take patience. I'm not a good sponsor. I sponsor no one. And God sees to it that I live on airplanes and am not in one place long enough to damage anybody. I talk to crowds, but one-on-one, a little impatient. I operate under the principle, I help you get well if you show me you already are. I've suffered impatience all my life. I presume most of us have. And so we pray for patience. And all through, God is giving us little helps to exercise patience, little tests. You ever been at an AA meeting and 5 minutes before the meeting opens, some guy tears in? Boy, did I need this meeting. I just had the worst day of my life. I had a flat on the way to work. Somebody creamed and totaled my car while I'm trying to fix the bloody flat. I get a broken arm, spent 4 hours in the hospital, so I'm late getting to work. The boss balls me out for missing 3 jobs. I had a fight with a secretary. I'm late going home. She screams because she had to burn the dinner on account of me. I cut myself shaving, burnt myself in the shower. What a day. Some old guy in the back of the room says, sounds to me like God gave you about 30 opportunities to grow and you blew them all. And that's exactly the way with me. I am able now to pick up about 3 out of every 20 opportunities because, ladies and gentlemen, it is virtually impossible to see God in the painful things that happen to us. I believe that pain is God's greatest gift to us humans. Pain is the fertilizer of growth. Pain is the fertilizer of growth. I believe with everything in me that nothing but good comes from everything. You remember the bleakness of your drinking years? It gave birth to this glorious sobriety. Just like the death that occurs in nature in the fall of the year translates itself into life in the spring. I believe that when pain enters my life, especially emotional pain, sorrow, depression, anything like that, it is nothing more than the dear Lord trying to put his arms around me. I believe pain is the most wasted resource on earth because I think we have taught each other that pain is evil. Avoid it. Do you know what we allow our kids to watch on TV? The ad that says, even in our sleepy little town, some of us can't get to sleep right away, so we take a drug. I don't know how you feel about that ad, but to me, that is frightening. Absolutely frightening. My painkiller acts 20 minutes faster than yours. Take mine. This is for adult headaches, double strength, etc. We're raised on that, and we alcoholics have a whole background of that. We had the best painkiller going, and we nearly drowned in it. And we can hardly tolerate pain without drugs. And so it's extremely difficult to see the hand of God in painful things. I don't know how you feel about your drinking years, but mine were not wasted. They were an apprenticeship for everything I'm doing right now. They were the university at the end of which I was presented my degree. It's called a doctorate in how to live. We make amends after having become willing to do... Hey, by the way, ladies and gentlemen, dead serious about this. Here's where you need your sponsor. Some amends are so tricky and have such dire implications. Don't ever try to do them alone. Please, I'm begging you. As a priest, I've tried to pick up some of the absolute chaos that has resulted from people doing things with lots of pep and no judgment. Most of it, listen to this. Have you ever heard this in an AA meeting? Do the amend, it'll make you feel good. The good old E over I philosophy. And I've seen men who, wanting to feel good, take their 5th steps to their wives and totally destroy another human being. I have seen human beings absolutely devastated by hearing things they should never hear. Except when to do so would injure them or others. For God's sake, get advice in making amends. Get advice. You know what I think AA is all about? Don't tell me how sick you got without telling me how well you're getting. I remember one fellow, God rest him, he's dead now. He died of cancer. Young man, strikingly handsome, great big fellow. He used to boast that on his last drunk, it took 6 cops to put him in jail, and he broke the jaw of one of them with his fist. And he said it with a smile. He never once mentioned paying that man's hospital bill. He never once mentioned putting groceries on that cop's table. I've heard men get up at an AA meeting and say, when I hit the depths, I actually stole pennies from my little 5-year-old girl's piggy bank. Beautiful. We all sit there in awe and say, isn't he wonderful? Well, I want to hear him tell me he put it back. You see, that is AA. My friends, any moron can talk the talk. It's walking the walk that counts. Do you know that an atheist can give a talk on faith? All he's got to do is read a book. AA does not consist on what we snow each other with at these meetings. AA consists on what we live in between them. The 12 steps are not meant to be talked about. They are meant to be done and then talked about. I think the most brilliant piece of AA literature is that magnificent little thing, A Member's Eye View of AA. If you haven't read it, you read it. I was privileged to have met the man who wrote that by mail. I wouldn't know him if I fell on him, but he was a dream. Step 10, we continue to take inventory when wrong promptly admitted it. AA does not want us to have a backlog of guilt to destroy us. Unresolved remorse will destroy us. That's why this is the only therapy on earth that has 2 inventories. The first one wipes out the past up till this moment, and step 10 keeps us clean from there on in so that there's no longer any buildup of guilt. Step 11, prayer. I used to spend a lot of time on that. My friends, do you know why we ought to pray? It's only fitting. If you acknowledge that the God of your understanding gave you the precious gift of sobriety, then we ought to have some sort of relationship with him. And if you need somebody to explain that to you, there's not a soul on earth capable of explaining it to you. And a relationship with God or any kind of contact with God is called prayer. Hey, did you ever notice how we get sober and after 3 weeks we're all spiritual experts? I don't go for those little formulas that I memorized when I was a kid. That's garbage, you know. That's the prayer of morons and so on. Me and God just talk. No, we don't. We talk. We talk him to death. Do you ever wonder what a Sunday morning is like in heaven? Really? All I can see is a dear Lord looking for a closet. Here they come again, you know. You know what I believe about prayer? It has nothing to do with volume. My friends, prayer is the lubrication of the soul. And if you don't pray, everything gets rusty in there and parts wear on parts. This is why I believe we have those bad days and we're itchy inside and we have no serenity and we don't know what's wrong. We're starving ourselves. Prayer is the food of the soul. Don't starve to death. There's no such thing as one kind of prayer being better than another. Have you ever tried to meditate after major surgery? Did you ever try to pray with a toothache? Do you know why we have different kinds of prayers? To fulfill different needs. I look on prayer as I look on clothing. You have a parka for the Arctic. You have a loincloth for the tropics. It's that simple. But meanwhile, we sit around a meeting, everybody's philosophizing about prayer. Ain't nobody praying. I look on prayer as I look on AA meetings. It is not numbers, it is consistency. Pray consistently. A minute a day is a rather cheap price to pay for sobriety. And step 12, our crowning glory. Ladies and gentlemen, it is truly possible for people to get sober outside of AA. I know a lot of them. I think you do too. But watch the snobbishness of many of us in AA. You know, the snobbishness of the have-not is really remarkable. From our exalted position in the gutter, we look down our noses at the people on the sidewalk. Now, doesn't that make sense? I know AAs who have gotten up and walked out of an AA meeting because there was an Al-Anon speaker there trying to teach them something about the family disease element of this thing. I live with a family. The mother is in AA. She has a brother who simply went back to his Baptist faith and functions on. If you don't take a drink, you can't get drunk. Beautiful sobriety. Beautiful man. He's a brother to me. I tell people, you know, I know a fellow who got sober on his own. He simply quit drinking. You know what the reaction is? Unhappiness. Oh? How long is he sober? And you say 12 years. And the frown deepens. Oh? They're disappointed. And then this brilliant statement. But he can't be doing that. It was in the wild. The difference between AA sobriety and other sobriety. When that man dies, his sobriety will die with him. And that will be tragic. And when May dies, she will have touched the lives of hundreds of thousands of people. I'll tell you about that in a minute. Bill Wilson was the man who dreamed the impossible dream, and he fought the unbeatable foe. He bore with unbearable sorrow and ran where the brave dared not go, but he knew if he'd only be true to his glorious quest, that his heart would lie peaceful and calm when laid to his rest. And the world has been better for this, that one man, one single man, scorned and covered with scars, still strove with his last ounce of courage. He reached the unreachable star. Bill Wilson, having plowed through this gigantic revision of himself, a total 180 degrees through the first 11 steps, having had a spiritual awakening as a result of these steps, we tried to carry the message to alcoholics. He stood on top of the mountain and he held within the arms of his heart that blinding jewel that men and women have been looking for centuries, sobriety. He had it. He had it. But you see, man is a creature composed in the image of God. He's a love machine. He was now capable of loving again. And love has an object outside itself. I love you. And that's just what he did. Goodness tends to diffuse itself. And he shared sobriety. And that's why this room is filled tonight. That's why rooms like this are filled all over the world. Because he shared. You know the 12th step that he wrote? We tried to carry this message to alcoholics. And many of us function this way, as if our books read. We tried to carry this message to alcoholics who picked up the telephone, called the central office, and asked us to. Friends, I'm not going to argue the point. I'm just going to tell you what happened in the beginning. Dr. Bob did not call Bill Wilson. Bill called him. And that's the way AA grows. That's the way AA grows. Your fifth tradition, the group has as its one primary purpose to carry the message to the alcoholic who still suffers. A young kid, 4 years sober, he's about 24 years old, came out of the house to visit us last summer. He said, my sponsor taught me that when a drunk calls you in the middle of the night, you're supposed to tell him to hang up and call back in the morning when he's sober. I said, oh? I said, Larry, just answer this one honestly. In your guts, do you really believe this is a disease? Oh, yes. I said, what's the main symptom of alcoholism? He said, drunkenness. I said, do you believe that diseases can be diagnosed and treated? Of course. I said, now answer this one. Suppose you're having a heart attack at 2 a.m. and you call a physician and you tell him that your left arm is hurting you so bad it's almost falling off and your chest is so congested you can't breathe, and he tells you to call back in the morning when the symptoms are gone. What would you think? And he sat there with his mouth open. How dare we lay down conditions under which we are going to allow someone a return to health? I'm not suggesting you walk into bars and knock people off of bar stools, not at all. I'm suggesting we use common sense, prudence, and experience to seek out the suffering alcoholic and offer him good health. That's what AA is all about. I saw the movie Patton. Do you know what the 12th step is? This is for all of us who talk gratitude. You know what gratitude is? The golden tray on which I offer to others what God has given me. The beauty of gratitude can be seen only in the ugliness of its opposite. My friends, everybody hates an ingrate. Don't tell me not to thank you. Ingratitude is the halitosis of the soul. It's the only thing that makes God Almighty turn his face away from us. But gratitude is something that you do not feel. It is something that you do. Step 12 is gratitude in action. It's called putting your money where the mouth is. I talked to a young guy in Baltimore one night, and he said, my godfather, if you want to experience real disillusion, go to an AA, get yourself on answering service. Go to an AA meeting and listen to the people who talk gratitude and then try to get them to go on a 12-step an hour later. Friends, if you're grateful, you won't have to tell me. I'll see it. I'll see it. Patton was one of the finest movies George Scott ever was in. He happens to have a little drinking problem, as you are aware from newspapers. I think Scott has signed contracts and been drinking when he's made some of the garbage he's been in, but boy, this was his masterpiece. Whether you liked Patton or whether you didn't has nothing to do with it. It was a masterful portrayal. Do you remember the first line that General Patton uttered in the beginning of that movie? I'll prepare you. He used the Anglo-Saxon word that you find in your dictionary, bastard, in it. And this is the way it began. It was the night before their invasion of Europe. He had 3 stars. He was a 3-star general. And he stood before his troops, thousands of them, in a huge airplane hangar. And he gave a very dramatic speech, and he began it this way. He said, gentlemen, no bastard ever won a war by dying for his country. We win wars by making some other poor, dumb bastard die for his country. And then he spoke of killing and bloodshed and war. It was a brilliant thing. Somewhere in those words, rattling around in my head when I first heard them, I said, there's some application to us alcoholics in that. After the third time I saw the movie, I was reading the breviary, the priest prayer book. And this single line from one of the Psalms nearly knocked me out of the chair. See what you hear. My neighbors stand afar off because of my affliction. My neighbors stand afar off because of my affliction. We alcoholics are like lepers. Remember in the time of Christ, the lepers called out to Christ for help from the hills to which they had been isolated? That's us. Our affliction has made our neighbors stand afar off, and then it hit me. We have become the bastards of humanity. We are the illegitimate children of humanity, put outside the pale by our disease. And this is what I heard the next time I saw Patton. No alcoholic bastard ever won the war against this disease by dying. 7 years ago, I went into a depression that just about floored me. I did not want to leave a dark room, if you can imagine that. My self-confidence was shattered. It was a beautiful summer, and the family I live with now invited me out to get well there. And through their magnificent love, I did. I was afraid to get well. I knew what it was like being sick, and I was scared to death of what it was like to be well. Depression is a horrid thing. I had had 2 major surgeries. I was 4 years without a teaching assignment. My life had no direction whatsoever. I was just running around AA, giving a chalk talk at one AA group after another. I was running out of gas and didn't know it till I got to the bottom of the hill. When I stepped on the accelerator, wasn't anything there, and I fell apart. I was on medication. The amount almost nil, but it nearly destroyed me. And I'll never forget as long as I live. One beautiful summer afternoon, I had the shades drawn. And May, the mother, was sitting on this side of the bed, and Alex, the son, was sitting over here, and I was sobbing. I spent the whole summer crying. And as if it were 1 minute ago, I said this. I said, May, I'm 45 years old, and all I have to show for it is that damn blackboard talk. She says, today, I didn't know what to say to you, but this is what she did say. She said, please get well, and one day you'll be giving that talk around the world. And it happened. 2 years later, the Navy made the film of that talk, and as a result, I've been asked 4 times to go to Europe, 2 to Asia, 1 to Panama, New Zealand, and last October I spoke at an AA meeting in Antarctica, where they have a few drunken penguins. I had a young man tonight, just before I walked up here to dinner. Handsome young fellow, and he's happy. He said, you don't know me, but you saved my life. And I was in New Orleans not too overly long ago. I spoke at a AA convention on a Sunday morning. After it was over, people were kind enough to come up and say hello. And a strikingly handsome man stood in front of me, absolutely impeccably dressed. If they had told me he was one of the 2 senators from the state, I would have accepted that. And very quietly, he said, "Father, alcohol put me in prison for 11 years. I never dreamed that I would ever look a man in the face and tell him that I love him, but he said, I love you." You don't buy that. People tell me what I do, I just say I died and went to heaven. That's what happened to me. I had a 22-year-old sailor in Norfolk, Virginia, come up to me after an AA meeting one night. He had a smile on his face you couldn't even describe. He shook my hand and said, "I just had to touch you," and he threw his arms around me. Do you know that I helped put that smile there? That's what my life is like now. And you know what else it is like? It's being invited to come here and share with you. I don't know most of you. But by opening your hearts to me, you just captured mine. Walter O'Keefe, the old-time entertainer, he must be close to 90 now. He's a brilliant, marvelous man. He has a line that has impressed me so deeply. He says, "Come live in my heart and pay no rent. That's all I have to offer you." But it's a genuine offer. Do you know what I've learned from AA? The world was spinning long before I came into it, and it's going to be spinning. You know, if I were to die tomorrow, I hope to God somebody would shed a tear. I mean that. But you know that 3 weeks from now, I would just be a memory. A happy one, I hope, but a memory. The world is not going to be any better off, you know, in a gigantic way because of anything I've ever said. But I hope to God it'll be better because of what I am. And because of what I've lived. Do you know really what AA is all about? Do you know how we best pass the message? By showing in our lives that sobriety has made us happy. Maybe somebody else will want to be happy with us. My dearest friend is a young fellow by the name of Stu Bramble. Marvelous name for an alcoholic. Stu and I are closer than father and son. 10 years ago, we were coming home from Washington, D.C., Stu used to drive me. Well, you could call it driving or flying, whichever. He's good God. But I'm useless after a talk. I'd usually go to sleep. I'm pooped. And Stu used to drive. We've logged thousands of miles together. And one night we were coming back from Washington. He said, "Hey, Father, you feel like talking?" I said, "All right." I knew he wanted to talk about something. He said, "Would you explain to me what those words, defects of character, mean?" He wasn't joking. This kid, I mean, there was no false pride in him. He didn't know what those words meant. It's 10 years later now, and the pupil has become the teacher. When that boy talks, I listen. He's one of the two, besides May. Hey, by the way, if any of you feel that I have done anything in your life for good, unto good, you can thank May for it. She's the one who saved my life 7 years ago. Stu is the other one. And I learned this from him, and I've passed it on every time I've opened my mouth in AA. He came into AA at the age of 24 out of the snake pit of one of our state hospitals. He went to 6 meetings and said, "I'm too young," and he went back to drink for another year. But the bottle brought him back. And when he came back the second time, he wanted sobriety, and he wanted it with a vengeance. He wanted 2 days of sobriety for every day that he breathed. And he used to go to meetings and just try to cram it all into his head. And he'd sit there with his fist doubled up in his mouth. And when the meeting was over, he could see his teeth marks in his fingers. And one night, he was in a marvelous meeting. And it was just so good. You know, everything that everybody said was really tops. You know, you hit one of them every 30, 40 years. And he was lucky enough to get one in the beginning. The meeting is over. The Lord's Prayer is said. They're all in the corner drinking coffee and eating cookies. And here's Stu sitting at the table all alone, frowning, biting his fist. And a lady with 15 years of sobriety came up to him. She says, "Stu," he says, "What?" She said, "Are you happy?" He says, "Yeah, I'm happy." She says, "Well, why in the hell don't you tell your face?" That's what sobriety is all about, for heaven's sake. You've heard it 1,000 times. If you meet somebody who doesn't have a smile, give him one of yours. Show me that it's good to be sober. And now comes the sad part. I spend my entire life getting on airplanes, meeting and falling in love, and then having to leave. And it grows increasingly painful. I would love to come back. I just don't know when that'll be. I hate goodbye, so I never say it. Like the Latins, I commend you to God. Adios adieu, addio. And always, people who love want to see each other again. Auf Wiedersehen, au revoir. In Italy, they say arrivedere, unto the seeing again. But in Rome, there's no place on earth with more pride of origin than Rome. To the Roman, Rome is the center of the world. And he never just says, till we meet again. He says, till we meet again here. Till we meet again here. Arrivederci. But before I say, till we meet again, let me share this with you from a non-alcoholic. Last November, a year ago, in Karamersel, Turkey, at an Air Force base, I met its commanding officer, Colonel Bobby Bagley. I was privileged to have had breakfast with him last February in Lackland Air Force Base in Texas. I'd like to tell you what I learned from him about pain and how to use it. He was shot down over North Vietnam and spent 7 years in prison at the Hanoi Hilton, as they called it. When his plane was shot up, he had to eject, and he landed bad. He broke his jaw, his back, and both arms, and he was tortured on top of that. He said, Father, I was reduced to being a screaming animal, groveling and screaming for relief. One characteristic that he shares with those men who were able to cope with prison is that they would not allow themselves to hate. They do not hate. They discovered that hatred destroys the hater, and so they speak about their captors and their torturers very impersonally. Men who could not cope came out and turned to alcohol or drugs. Some are in mental institutions. They'll never get out. Some men just committed suicide. They just could not cope with freedom. But listen to this from Bagley. He said, I came to my relationship with God in that prison through the creatures that he allowed me to have for comfort, flies and fleas and bugs. And he made a statement that almost knocked me out of the chair. He said, I had a beautiful relationship with a mother rat. Most people believe rats are dirty, but this lady was blind. She had only 3 legs, and she was raising 3 babies. And he said, Father, I learned how to live from her. He said, she never gave in to self-pity. Isn't it awful how we alcoholics burn up our sponsors? I mean, burn them out when we call and say, I hurt. You make me feel good. He said, she never once gave in to self-pity. She knew she was blind. She knew she was lame. She functioned accordingly. I used to watch her grope her way out of the cell looking for food to feed her babies. It always saved her some of mine. And he said, on the days they would torture me, however, and throw me in the cell late, he said, on the floor would be my little bowl of swill, but he said she never went near it and wouldn't let her babies go near it till I had retrieved what was edible. And he said, after I had eaten, she would come and feed herself and her young. But even in prison, nothing remains the same. Things change. The inevitable happened. They grew up and left, and so did she. And this perfectly intelligent flyer said, I was without my best friend. He then made what to me is the most impressive and profound statement I have ever heard from human lips. He said, Father, do you know how much God loved me? When she became pregnant again, she came back to my cell to have her new babies. God, I could have knelt in front of that man. So we have a lot to learn, don't we? For that reason, I do not wish you joy without a sorrow, nor endless day without the healing dark, nor brilliant sun without the restful shadow, nor tides that never turn against your bark. I wish you faith and strength and love and wisdom, goods, gold enough to help some needy one. I wish you songs, but also blessed silence and God's sweet peace when every day is done. My dearest friends, I commend you to God till we meet again. Arrivederci.